Do you remember your first meeting?
Well, I do. Actually, the first that I ever saw her, I was out sweeping the pavement and hosing it down, or bucketing it down, because the streets in Alice Springs at that time, in about 59 to 60, the bitumen didn't extend to the footpath, so you always had the dust coming up and going over everything. And I'm out there bucketing water all over the place, and Miss Pink came along and she said, Mr. Brown, are you a socialist? And I said, I've never thought about it. Why do you ask? And she said, well, you're doing this manual work. And I said, oh, look, I was trained to do manual work years ago. There's no problem. And she said, oh, you must be a socialist then. So she was very happy with that. So I let her think that if that's what she wanted. But at any rate, she was introduced to me by Linda Gorry, who had the shoe shop just opposite us. Linda was an old friend, and Linda had told me a little bit about her. And there was this, what I thought, of course, in those days, I was only in my early, 26. And for a woman of 75, you know, she was really old, as far as I'm concerned. I was concerned. However, a gracious sort of lady, dressed up like somebody out of the Victorian era, with a white blouse, embroidered blouse, and high at the neck, long black skirt, with a hat. I can't remember the hat, but it was there. And anyway, quite a regal woman.
Very dignified, apparently, in her bearing.
Oh, extremely dignified. Her words were well chosen. Each word meant something. There was nothing superfluous in anything she said.
A lot of people have said that she was very intelligent. Was that your impression?
My impression was, yes, that she was a person who'd had a very good education, which was surprising because a lot of people in her day had left school in grade five. In fact, my mother, who wasn't as old as that, had left school in grade five to mind the rest of the family, and so had a lot of aunties and uncles. So for this lady who spoke well, had obviously to me had a very, very good education, just by the way she framed her words and sentences, it was a surprise for a lady that age, yes.
And in that sense, I suppose, for those times, quite unusual in a town like Alice Springs for a woman, well, of any age, yes, to be quite so well educated.
Yes, yes, that's right. Most people up there had, most of the older ones had been brought up on the land, and she was definitely an import who'd become acclimatised to things, yes.
Do you think that created a certain distrust of her? I mean, you have that anti-intellectualism that is still evident in Alice Springs, but in those days, I guess, with tensions the way that they were and the developments, I guess, on the frontier and the things to which Olive Pink was dedicated, obviously
as we got to know her more, it became obviously that she was obvious to us that she was an idealist, and I don't think many of the people whose great concern was keeping their animals alive really had a lot of time to begin to think about ideals. They were much more concerned with keeping stock alive and getting enough food to feed themselves, and the immense problems of distance with freights and things. I think that occupied a lot of their time. I didn't meet a lot of philosophers of that age group, actually.
Did she talk to you about her ideals?
Only vaguely, because, you see, at that stage, everyone thought they knew what she was about, and I suppose that being the case, she didn't think it necessary to explain to people what her particular leanings in life were. But as the years passed, she did reveal piece by piece little pieces. For instance, She did mention to me the story that everyone now knows, that she was a draftswoman and she worked on the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and she was brought up in Tasmania, and she had quite a cultured background there. One of the books that she gave me much later on was given to her by a gentleman whose brother was the tutor to the key dive of Egypt. So she was very proud of that fact, that the family had associations that were quite important in the world. She wasn't a person to mince words. Her words were fairly well chosen, as I said, but if she felt strongly enough about something, and she did, of course, about the Indigenous people, she felt that they'd been dealt with badly. In her opinion, they'd been dealt with very badly, and her ideal was that they should have been allowed to lead their traditional ways of life without interference from the settlers that came in. And I think that's what she tried to do. She told me that she'd spent so many years out in the bush, completely isolated, and I think that she really made an attempt to find out what the thoughts of these people were. It was difficult for other people because they had their own thoughts. They looked at the situation they found the Indigenous people in and thought, this is dreadful, we'll have to do something about this. But of course they didn't look at them in the eyes of an Indigenous person and say, is this what we want to do? And I think that's what Miss Pink tried. She tried to put herself in their mindset.
Mm. Do you think that she was unique in that regard in Alice Springs?
Well, look, a lot of people really tried extremely hard, and it took a long time for certain things to penetrate. I know that the Lutherans up at Hermannsburg went in with their own ideals, and many, many, many years later, they looked at the progress that had been made and on a number of occasions felt that perhaps they could have gone another way. I think Miss Pink was the person who was the thinker who went in, didn't try to change anything, looked at what she saw, and then expressed an opinion.
Well, there's been some discussion about how she felt, you know, in the last decade or two of her life that perhaps that she had, her ideals had been damaged, or that she'd had a sense that she hadn't been able to stop the damage that was happening to Aboriginal people.
Well, I think you've expressed that quite well, yeah. She did actually say that she felt that she hadn't succeeded. She was disappointed that she devoted so many years to this cause as she saw it, and she hadn't succeeded. And I think she felt the same way as the chappie I met in in Fiji, who said, look, you only need one transistor radio in a village, and the whole structure of the village is destroyed. And I think that's what she could see happening, and she tried to, in her own way, stop it, but it's very difficult. Civilizations meet and there are problems and adaptions, and I think she didn't like the adaptions much.
She had incredibly high standards. I mean, the issue, I guess, that a lot of people, including Doreen Breitling and others, pointed out, how do you stop the single transistor radio getting into the community, especially, you know, when they'd already wanted the transistor radios, they wanted the access.
Well, of course, it's a bit like the Romans invading Britain, isn't it? How did you stop the Britons becoming Romanised? It's very, very difficult. And I don't really think that... you have to put yourself also, we all do, in the mindset of those people back in the 20s and earlier who were meeting these people. They had their own ideas. I mean, it was the grand day of the British Empire, and so the idea was to spread the good word of the Empire, and as long as everyone's in the Empire, we'd all be safe and happy. It's It's one of those things. Even I was brought up that way in South Australia. Very, very, very British, very loyal. And the British way was the best way. I think that she was terribly disappointed that she hadn't been successful. And I think in the end she felt it was no good really even preserving what she knew about them, because it would be of no use, a different evolved group of people. That was her opinion.
Do you think that in some ways perhaps the garden was a retreat or even a place where she thought possibly she could have some success because it didn't involve people?
Well, I think that's a natural thing to assume. She was very, very interested in plants. And, of course, plants don't argue with you. It's a bit like having pets. And if you know a little bit about botany, everything seems to be in a grand order. And I think she appreciated that. It was probably like all of us have a retreat we can go to, something that doesn't argue with us, something we can understand, something we don't have to battle with all the time.
Did you visit her there?
Oh, yes. Yes, as the years passed, well, we had our little differences, of course, and what would happen there is that something would upset her, and on the spur of the moment she'd say something, and we'd think, oh, we won't be seeing Olive for a while, and sure enough, it'd take a few months or perhaps even a year, and then she'd appear, and we'd be great friends.
What did she talk to you about? What kind of things?
Well, she did mention a little bit of her early days when she was a draftswoman. She was very proud of that. And as I said before, she was very proud of the fact that her family was well connected. She never spoke about the gentleman that apparently she was engaged to, the First World War. Most of the things she spoke about were fairly mundane, just as most of our conversations today are fairly mundane. And she was concerned at change. For instance, I had a chemist shop. She would have a favourite lotion that she'd put on her dry skin. It was called Olivol. Now, it's off the market now, never heard of these days. But in those days, it was a great, great seller. Even in Alice Springs, it was a great seller. And she would buy a little bottle of this lotion about once every 3 months or so. And one day she came in and she said, "Mr. Brown, I'm returning this rubbish to you," because it had the word new on it, new improved. And she said, "Why did they do it?" And I said, "I don't know, Miss Pink. These things happen." And she said, "It's inferior." And if you wanted to upset her, you present her with something with the word new on it. And and now that I'm old myself, now that I'm 75, I feel like one of those grumpy old men on television. The things she complained about, I could complain about too. If you've got a good product and you're using it, you might have your favourite margarine, perhaps, pick on a mundane thing, and you go to buy it one day and it's new, and you open it, and it's rubbish. And I must admit, I was a bit like Miss Pink, and I rang up the manufacturers and said, "You've ruined your formula." I did notice later on they brought out the original product again, so they might have taken notice of me. But no one took much notice of Miss Pink's complaints.
So, in some senses, right or wrong, you could see her as a woman, as a person who fought against change.
Yeah, she fought against change, and I think that's why she dressed the way she did. She knew very well that she stood out a mile differently to other people. But she was maintaining what she felt was a standard, and the change did upset her. She didn't like it much.
Over what period of time did you know? How many years was it, or did you know until she died?
We were there for 14 years, and I think she died about 18 months after we left at the Alice. So a reasonable time, but of course her younger life. No knowledge of that. I was there from 1959 until about 1973. So it wasn't a bad period, but of course it was a particular period in her life too. And so I never saw the other Olive Pink that other people had seen. And that's the Olive Pink that you hear the fanciful stories about and the interesting stories. And if you looked at anyone's life, you could, if you looked over a period of 50 years, you could find some funny things that you could poke fun at.
Sure. What did you like about her?
Oh, well, I rather liked her consistency, actually. I mean, she didn't please me. She was a person who made no effort to cultivate a particular friendship. She was Olive Pink, and you accepted her, and she accepted me. And I think that's probably why, in the end, we got along quite famously. She used to ring up once a month and say, "Mr. Brown, Olive Pink here. I would like you to come to my residence next Wednesday afternoon and enjoy a glass of, as I remember it, sherry and a piece of Madeira cake." Mm. And I'd go down there about once a month and have the glass of sherry, as I remember it, but someone else tells me it wasn't sherry at all, it was Bickford's cordial, but I remember it as sherry. And because she would always have something for medicinal purposes, any rate. But so we'd just look around the garden, and she'd show me the various plants, which I knew not very much about at all. And I think it was just a little bit of companionship where that's where we talked about these sorts of things.
So you don't have great memories of the garden?
No, not at all. The only memories that I have of being shown around, and this would be a tree here, and 1 month it would have, say, Glenn Hewitt's name on it and a little note on it. And the next time I'd come, he was out of favour and it would have someone else's name on it. So she sort of named plants after the people she had contact with. I wasn't ever privileged enough to have a plant with my name appearing on it, or a tree, but that was all right too. Yeah.
Why do you think that was? I mean, she obviously liked you. Were you not old enough, or...?
It possibly had something to do with it. I mean, various people were very kind to her, and they'd had their names on trees over a period. There are people that she would ask to be executors in her will and administrators for some purpose or other, and she would name the trees after them.
I'm not sure that she had named too many trees after friends, because quite a few of her close friends don't seem to have had trees named after her.
No, I never saw a tree with Sheila Owen's name on it.
Well, I was just thinking of Sheila, yeah.
No, I think she took us as we were, and we took her as she were, or as she was. And I think that that was quite a good arrangement. You accept me, I will accept you, and I don't want to change you, and you don't want to change me.
I've just got to ask you a couple of details about, because we're interested in what the place looked like and, you know, the hut. Did she entertain you in her hut or outside?
Yes, well, the hut was pretty sparse, you know. It had a chair and a table, if I'm trying to remember things. Minimal furnishings, pretty Spartan, a bit like camping inside a room, actually. For some time it was very, very hot, because, as you know, you live in Alice Springs, it does get hot. Reg Harris was very kind one day and picked her up, put her in the car, said, we're going for a ride. And while they're going for the ride, Herman Weaver came in and installed an evaporative air conditioner. She was very, very annoyed about it, but actually very pleased. And she spoke highly of Reg later on, and Herman Weaver felt what they'd done for her. Yeah.
You know the story of how it said, I guess the irony, that she used the air conditioner to shorten her life, well, even to kill herself, arguably, when she put it on a winter's night and lay on the floor. Have you heard that story?
No, I haven't heard that one at all. I wouldn't have thought it would have made any difference to a lady who used to camp out bush in the freezing conditions. I mean, older people quite often feel that their life's at an end, and some don't eat, some don't drink any water anymore. Some might do what you just said, but it sounds too elaborate for Miss Pink, though.
Mm-hmm.
The Miss Pink that I knew would have merely just camped outside and froze to death in the cold out there, because the frosts were pretty severe.
Did you think, I mean, you knew her right up until that last year and a half of her life. Some people say, the people who didn't like her, you know, for example, Judy Robinson knew her quite well, and in fact, Miss Pink took an interest in Judy when she was young because she had artistic talent. But she describes Miss Pink as being quite embittered, quite unhappy, and didn't laugh much. Would you say that was the case?
Well, no, I've heard her laugh. No, she was capable of laughter, and she was, you see, it's very difficult. There's a technique in talking to people where you align themselves with their interests. So if you're talking to somebody and they're what you call a difficult person, you tend to use the same trends and tendencies in conversation they have, and you can have quite a decent conversation with them. But I don't know whether it'd be a valid criticism. She was embittered that things hadn't worked out, not for her, but for the Indigenous people, the way that she would have liked them to. So I suppose, if it's been your life's work, you've devoted all those years to doing something and it hasn't happened, against all the efforts on your part, it's gone in a different direction, then I suppose you would be embittered. But now, I think she was more disappointed than anything.
I see.
I don't think she was bitter.
And would you say that she was an influence? You knew her from when you were 28. Did she influence the way that you looked at things?
Well, I think that she probably, by her example of accepting me for what I was and getting me to accept her for what I was, she probably gave me a great helping hand, because as a business person, it wasn't in anyone's interest to severely criticise somebody just because you didn't like them. They were a human being like you were. And in Alice Springs, of course, it was a great lesson, one of the biggest lessons of life, that we're all washed up together 1,000 miles from anywhere. And these were your companions, whether you liked it or not. A bit like being in a ship and never getting off it. And people did, certainly in the time I was there, to a large extent act in that way. They would associate with people with whom down in the city they would never do such a thing. They would appreciate their opinions. They might disagree violently. For instance, at an election, Aileen Kilgariff was giving out tickets for her husband. D.D. Smith was there giving out tickets for himself. D.D. Didn't look well. Aileen said to him, and I was there when it happened, she said, "D.D., you silly old bugger, go home, have a rest." And he said, "I can't, I've got to give out these tickets." She said, "Well, give them to me, I'll give them out." So there was this election, Aileen giving out Labor Party tickets and giving out tickets for her husband. That's the sort of attitude that was certainly evolved in Alice Springs. And I think Miss Pink may have been one of those things. That we got on with Miss Pink, even though she mightn't have been a person with whom we'd readily associate normally. But she was there, we were there, and that was it.
But you're also suggesting that to some degree that was mutual, that despite her crankiness, she did accept people to a degree.
Oh, she did. She did. Of course, it mightn't have pleased her, but she was willing to accept to a degree, yes.
So she would often tell people what she thought of them.
Oh, yes, yes.
But there was a good chance that she would forgive you later on.
Yes, she would. She would do that. She had an argument one day with us. She was selling some flowers in the shop, and I was getting hay fever. I didn't mind her selling the flowers in the shop, but I was getting hay fever, and I asked her if she could sell them outside. Well, there was an immediate reaction, and she said she would never, never come inside my shop ever again. Of course, later on, somebody told her that I was getting hay fever and I couldn't breathe properly. She came in and she did say she was sorry, which was pretty good for Miss Pink saying she was sorry. Yeah.
There's not many apologies on record.
Not many apologies, no.
I think it's interesting what you say because, Don, because I think that kind of feeling or attitude does still exist in Alice Springs, but it depends. It's a matter of time now. The longer that you're in town, the more you're likely to accept other views, whereas people perhaps in the short term can stay in their own enclaves.
Well, yes. Yes, there's always the people that are sent on a two-year stint, and the first part of the two-year stint, they say, how can I live in this place? I want to go back. My company won't send me back. If only... or if only my husband would be sent back to civilization again, somewhere decent. 3 months later, they're saying, oh, it's not that bad. Another 3 months on, they're not mentioning it. 6 months later on, they're saying, oh, I've been posted back to Sydney or Melbourne. I don't really want to go, you know. So the place does have an effect on people.
I've just got one last question, the typewriter.
That typewriter was the typewriter that she took with her on all her travels. I'm pretty well certain she told me she had that when she went up to see Daisy Bates and stayed with her. And she took it with her, and all her letters that I've ever seen were typed on that typewriter. She took a few things with her. For instance, I've got a book here in front of me. One day I'll send it up to the collection again, but I'll enjoy it while I'm still alive. And it was the history of the conquest of Peru, to give you an idea what she used to read at night. And another one is a book, the date in it is 16491, so it's 1891. And that was her book of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Now, what else have I got? I've got another one here, The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. It gives you a little insight into the way she was thinking. She had a range of thoughts that she didn't share with people, but she did give me these things. And I've also got, where are we? Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare. Sent to me, I think, from London in 1896, probably by Aunt Sarah. So she treasured a few things, so I'm treasuring them, and one day they'll go back to the Olive Pink collection up there.